All right, welcome back to a new episode of the EITF Project, everyone. We have a returning guest with us today. You would have seen him on our special episode after season one. Manjunath Gokhale, our friendly EITF lawyer, has immigration lawyer, has joined us to talk about part two of what we spoke about the last time. So welcome to the show, first of all, Manjunath.
Thank you, Nandini. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be doing this and looking forward to an exciting session.
Thank you. So, you know, to get started, I want to talk to our new followers and our new viewers. I'm going to link the first episode for you guys up here. But in the first episode, we spoke about what it takes to move from a student visa to an H-1 visa and what happens if you get laid off on an H-1 visa. We spoke about OPTs, CPTs, J-1 visas, H-4s, all of those options that you have. So make sure to check out that video. And this is going to be part two of that video as to what happens after you get the H-1 until you can get your I-140. So diving right into what's happening today. So today, the job market specifically is in a lot of fluctuation. There are a lot of people that are losing jobs. There are a lot of people who are afraid to move to new companies, who are on visas, who are on H-1 visas. So I'm going to address all of these nuances of having a visa and moving forward in your career while you're on your H-1. So to begin with, Manjunath, once someone gets an H-1 visa, how long is the H-1 visa valid? This is for our viewers who don't know, so I'm starting from the beginning. How long is an H-1 visa valid and how many times can they renew it?
Yeah, good question. So to segue from the last topic, we had already talked about F-1 and other issues in quite detail. So people normally graduate from universities and then they stay on their OPT. So you have two OPTs. One is the post-completion OPT for 12 months. And then if you're a graduate of a STEM program, you get two more years of OPT. It's called STEM OPT. So for a total of 3 years. And during these 3 years, most students would transition from the F-1 visa to the H-1B. H-1B is a non-immigrant work visa. It's important to note that it's a dual intent visa, which means you can have a non-immigrant intent and an immigrant intent at the same time. And so filing a green card on H-1B does not conflict with the H-1B. H-1Bs are for a total duration of 6 years, Nandini. You get initially 3 years and you get a 3-year extension. So that's the end of 6 years. End of 6 years, the H-1B ends. But there are provisions in the law to extend the H-1B beyond 6 years, provided you have your green card going on. So if you have your labor certification, if you have your I-140 approved, there are ways to extend your H-1B beyond 6 years. That's what ends up happening. Given the backlogs for India, most people will not be able to get the green card within their 6 years of H-1. So they will look to ways for ways to extend the H-1B beyond 6 years. And there are provisions, and we will delve into that as we proceed through this conversation.
It's interesting, you know, that you say that the 6 years for the H-1 was put in place originally so that someone could get a green card within 6 years. I think it's been a long time since someone has been able to get a green card, employment-based green card within 6 years. So
especially for India.
Yeah, especially for India. So it feels like a very outdated kind of time that they've given us, right? For the
absolutely.
Yeah. Building on what you've said for green card applications and everything, what is the process for someone to move from an H-1B to at least to get in line for a green card today? What are the different types of employment-based green cards that are available, and what's the advantage of one over the other?
So in terms of we touched upon the backlogs for India, right? So India is heavily backlogged. There are three queues, broadly speaking, for India: EB1, EB2, EB3, not just for India, for everybody. And EB2 and EB3 are heavily, heavily backlogged for India. So there's no way on earth anybody can reach the finish line within 6 years. So to answer your question, yes, the paths on EB1, EB, these are the three preference categories for employment-based immigrant visas. EB2 is people with advanced degrees, like people with master's degrees or people with bachelor's degrees and 5 years of experience. If the position requires that, you can fall into the EB2 queue. EB3 is for less than that, you know, for somebody with just a bachelor's degree or bachelor's degree plus less than five years of experience would fall under EB3. EB3s tend to be more backlogged than EB2, although there have been times where EB3 has been faster than EB2, but that's more of an aberration. Typically, if you have a master's degree, I would say you want your preference should be to be in the EB2 queue as opposed to EB. EB1 is a special sort of category. There are three kinds of visas within EB1, EB1A, EB1B, and EB1C. EB1A is for people with extraordinary ability. And it's a self-petition. You don't need an employer to sponsor you for that. And it's for people with extraordinary ability in science and arts and business and athletics. EB1B is for outstanding professors and researchers. These are people with PhDs and 3 years of work experience in academia and research and or research. EB1C is for people who are multinational managers. So these are people who come, say, through an intercompany transfer from a foreign company to a US company, and they qualify for EB1C category to file a green card in EB1. The thing to note about EB1 categories, you don't need a labor certification. You can directly go into the I-140. Typically, green cards have three steps: labor certification of perm, followed by I-140, followed by I-485, adjustment status. EB2 and EB3 paths require you to first get the perm done, then I-140, then 485. Whereas EB1 people, they bypass labor, perm, and they go directly into I-140, followed by I-485. So those are broadly the three categories. Not everything applies to everybody, and most people don't qualify for EB1. So most people traditionally go the EB2 or EB3 route. Yeah.
Right.
Makes sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think I learned a couple of new things as well. There's always something new you uncover when you talk to an immigration lawyer, even though you have so much research that's out there. But I want to take you back a little bit. You spoke about labor certification, right? And you mentioned that EB1 does not require labor certification. So what does labor certification entail today? How long is it taking for one to get a perm certified or a labor certification certified in the market today? What are the wait times?
Yeah, perm is labor certification process. It's an online filing. It takes a long time. These days, it's taking almost a year to file the perm. So if you say, if Nandini comes to me and says, your employer wants me to file a perm for you, and we are in month of September, if I start the case today, it's going to be filed next year, September 2025. The most of the delay there is in obtaining what's called prevailing wages from the Department of Labor. That's taking almost 6 months. And once you get the prevailing wages, you have to recruit for the position. And there's a cool off period of 30 days once the recruitment is complete. So to get all of those things done, it's a 12-month process. And upon filing online through the FLAG system, it's another 12-month process typically to get an approval. So if all goes well, you're looking at 2 years.
Right.
Start to finish.
You know, you mentioned that there's going to be recruiting for a position and there's, you know, a 60-day like cool-off period after recruiting and all of that. Like, you know, someone is in the middle of a perm process. They just got their prevailing wage determination, which is what is predominantly called PWD, right? And then they go for recruitment. And in the middle of all of this, you never know what's going to happen. There are layoffs in the company. How can a layoff in a company affect your perm process, even if you have not been laid off?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And it's a question we are getting. I see a lot of that in our own practice. So you're working for a big company and you're filing the labor certification for, or working on a labor certification for employee A. And then within that area of intended employment, five other people are laid off, right? Yeah. So that poses a problem because you have to answer a question on that form when you're filing the labor, has the employer had any layoffs? And so if the answer is yes, then there's no filing. You cannot file this case. You have to wait because otherwise you have to extend the offer out to the people who have been laid off, and there are certain procedures to be followed. So most employers, once we explain what the requirements are, they'll say, let's wait. And so the wait time is like 6 months. If you're in the middle of a perm process and then the employer has also had layoffs in that area of intended employment, they cannot file the perm for the foreign national for 6 months.
Yeah. And the process here is that the perm has to be filed within the 6 years that your H-1 is valid, right?
Usually for India, people from India, I say start the labor certification process within the first 3 years of your H-1B.
Yes.
Because I explained, it takes 2 years to file the perm, right? So or to get the perm approval, 1 year to file, 1 year to receive an approval. So you don't want to wait until, you know, fifth year of your H-1B to start the perm, because you will lose the ability to extend your H-1B beyond 6 years. So we get a lot of those cases where people come to me with 1 year left on H-1B, 1.5 years left on H-1B, and they say, can we do something here to keep this employee in the U.S.? And I say, it's really late, because even if I start the perm today, it's not going to get filed before the end of 5 years of it. There's no way I can get an I-140 approved for MRR before the H-1B expires. So it's kind of too late. Earlier, I used to use a rule of thumb, Nandini, where I would say, start the perm at least with 2 years left on H-1.
Right.
Now I say, start the perm with 3 years left on H-1, which means by the time you're first, sooner the better. So if you can start within the first 6 months of your H-1B, nothing like it, but no later than 3 years of H-1.
I agree with your assessment that 3 years of H-1 today, I think, is minimum to file for a perm.
Yeah.
And like you said, the PWD takes 6 months, and then there's a recruiting process that takes about 2 to 3 months, right? So that's a total of 9 months. And if there is any layoff in the company that kind of shows that there's a U.S. worker that's been laid off that has a similar position, you have to restart the PWD all over again, which could be another 9 months before you can file for the perm, right? So because of this, and also there is a possibility that when they recruit for your position, there is a U.S. worker that's available and the recruitment fails, in which case you again have to start the PWD all over again. These are cases that I've heard more often these days, especially because there's so many people that have been laid off that are in the market with more experience than the candidate filed for the perm.
Sometimes it does happen.
So these are the risks for the first two portions of filing for an I-140, right? Then once these two are done, then you file for the perm. What are the risks that can occur once you file for the perm? Like, I've heard of requests for more information from the Department of Labor, which can take longer for the perm to get approved before you go for your I-140. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Most of the perms do get approved without an audit.
Okay.
But a small percentage of the perms which get filed do get picked up for an audit. Those audits are truly random, meaning Department of Labor will say, okay, we will audit 15% of the cases which we have in our system. So you may be one of them who is impacted by the audit. So when there's an audit, you have to submit the whole file to the U.S. to the Department of Labor. And then it's a separate track at that point. They have to review the file and issue a decision. Most of the times they do get approved, no problem, but it delays the process. And that's where I emphasize the quality of the lawyer you use is very important, because ETA 9089, the perm filing is an online filing. A lot of times when DOL asks for the paper filing, the entire documentation, if they find any mistake, even the silliest of mistakes, they will deny the perm. And that will set you back by a year, year and a half or more, right? So it's very essential that the law firm you work with has a reputation of, you know, getting cases approved even after an audit, which means they document their case as well, follow all the processes, follow the regulations, all the I's are dotted, T's are crossed, right? So files have to be intact. Like in our office, we audit these files multiple times before we file it. So the file is, we'll have exhibits A through K, you know, that's how we organize our files. And I check everything, right? For every time, each step of the way. Because when you electronically submit the ETA 9089 to the Department of Labor, you should be comfortable and confident that file is intact. If tomorrow DOL wants to come back and audit your file, by all means, take it, look at it. So there has zero room for error. I cannot overemphasize this point. I mean, you know, so DOL does pick up cases for audit, and you want to make sure that your file is really well prepared, that even if there's an audit, it's going to withstand the scrutiny of DOL. And they do go through with a fine-tooth comb and look at everything that the employer has done. And they want to, you want to make sure that there's no mistakes there.
Yeah. So so what is the, how long does DOL take to kind of certify a perm for someone? Because I think until the perm is certified and you file for an I-140 with the USCIS, right? And until you get that I-140 in your hand, you can't renew your H-1 beyond the 6 years, correct?
So there are two ways to renew the H-1B beyond 6 years. One is filing of a perm before 5 years of H-1.
Right.
So if you just merely file the perm, or even the I-140 before the end of 5 years of your H-1, you get 1 year extensions. But to get full 3 year extensions, you have to have the I-140 approved before the end of 6 years.
I see.
So it's two different bases, like 106A and C of AC21 are the applicable sections of the law. You can file an extension based on a perm being pending. And you can also file an H-1 extension based on the approval of the I-140. Approval of the I-140 is a long, you'll get a full 3 year extension.
I see. Okay. I learned something new there as well. So I want to dial back a little bit to something that you said, right? Where you have cases that are coming to you where employers are asking to retain a specific employee in the company who has 1.5 years left on their H-1. With the Department of Labor wait times for the PWD and the perm today, it's almost impossible to get to the I-140 stage by this time. Are there other ways that a candidate can skip the DOL line? I'm hearing a lot about national interest waivers being filed with USCIS. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
So national interest waiver is an EB-2 filing, and it's a self-petition. You don't even need an employer for that. You can file it yourself if you qualify. Not everybody qualifies for an IW, but USCIS, in my experience, has been fairly liberal in their approvals of NIWs compared to historical trends, right? So I've been doing this for 25 years. NIWs, I think, has gotten a little easier, which is why you seem to see a lot of discussion of NIWs in the, you know, social media space like LinkedIn and whatnot. We also filed a fair amount of NIWs, and they do get approved. I recommend if somebody is looking at it, not filing through premium processing, file as a regular case, and make sure the documentation is properly prepared, strong, and all that. So basically, to explain the concept of an NIW, National Interest Waiver, you're asking the USCIS, or you're asking the US government, to allow you to bypass the labor certification process. Mm-hmm. So like I explained earlier, EB-2 cases do require perm, labor certification. So NIW is EB-2, and you're asking the USCIS to allow you to bypass, skip the labor certification. Why would they do that? They would do that if the project, the area you're working on has substantial merit and it's got national importance, right? So if you can establish that, and if you can establish that you're well-positioned to execute this proposed endeavor, and also on balance, when USCIS balances the interest of protecting US workers through the labor certification process and allowing you, the foreign national, to bypass the labor certification process, this, your side, your arguments are stronger, which means they allow you to bypass labor. So it all depends on the area you work. So they, as long as the, like I explained, if it has substantial merit, it has to be national in scope, you can do it. And so, for example, some of the areas we have worked on are in green energy kind of projects, renewable energy, EVs, vaccine research, HIV, cancer research. So all kinds of things, areas where people are doing good work. And if they're successful in the work they're doing, it's going to benefit US immensely. And the benefit is sort of like national in scope. So if you can establish all that, they will allow you to, they will approve the I-140 without the labor.
I see.
So that's how the NIW process works. in a very nutshell, you know, if I can explain it very concisely, that's how
just
I would explain.
A little bit deeper into that, because I'm hearing a lot about these NIWs these days, even for people that are in tech, right?
AI is a huge area.
With the rise of AI and everything, there are a lot of people right now in tech that qualify for NIW. What would you say makes a strong NIW application? Say, for example, does a candidate need to be a patent holder? How many papers? Or what is a strong NIW application according to you?
A strong one will have good reference letters, recommendation letters, and sometimes U.S. government participation on the project also helps. So the successful NIW cases we have had recently have all been with NIH and Department of Energy, EPA, and, you know, governmental agencies are willing to give you reference letters saying that so-and-so, the work they're doing is important and it's it has substantial merit. It's got national importance and we need to support it. So if you can get recommendation letters like that from the government, from the private sector and your peers, you know, 3-4 good letters, that really strengthens the case. And they tend to have slightly better advantage, more of an advantage compared to somebody in the private sector. Not to say that it cannot be done for the private sector employees, right? So we have done NIW cases where people are working in tech and people are working in the industry and they're working in cutting edge areas like AI, machine learning and whatnot. And so long as there is proper documentation of the work being done, that it's of a high quality, the foreign national is, you know, well positioned to work in that area, and there are reference letters from other people in the field, it's going to work out. So for me, I mean, you know, I always do an evaluation on all these cases. I will never work on it without reviewing the evidence. If I feel, you know, in the interest of everybody's time, I always review it and I'll give my assessment to the client saying that I feel reasonably confident that I can get this done. Only then you proceed, because, you know, you don't want to raise people's hopes and expectations and fall short.
Right. And I also noticed one thing that you said in your answer, where you said if you file for an NIW using normal processing versus premium processing, what are the advantages of filing for an NIW with USCIS in normal processing versus premium processing?
The only reason why I said that is premium gets a lot of RFEs.
Yeah, okay.
So you want to avoid RFEs. And a lot of times RFEs tend to be frivolous.
Okay.
USCIS just wants to buy time and they will kick back an RFE just to gain more time. So if the time is not, I mean, you know, if you're not in a big crunch, I would say just file as a regular case. Prepare the case well, do a good job, thorough job, and let USCIS take their time in giving you the answer. So that's the calculation between premium versus a regular.
Okay. And for those of you in our audience who don't know, a premium processing with USCIS usually requests that they give you an answer within 15 calendar days or 15 business days, right?
Yeah, it used to be calendar days. It's business days now. And also I-140s have a different timeline. I think it's 30 business days, if I'm not mistaken.
I see. Yeah. So kind of summarizing it all up, to get an I-140, you need to start with your PWD application, which takes 6 months and 3 months for your recruitment. And about how long does it take for DOL today to like give you a perm certification? 9 months?
1 year.
1 year. So it's like a year and 9 months total to be able to file an I-1 if you don't qualify for an NIW. And if you do qualify for an NIW, then you can file right in the beginning, even without a PWD. Is that correct?
Yeah, you don't need a perm at all, right? So you directly file the I-140. It's a different kind of I-140 filing. We have done where I've started the perm process and that's going on. And I also filed an EB-2 national interest waiver separately. So if it works out, then I can abandon the EB-2, the perm process. So you can start both simultaneously.
I see.
If the evidence supports the filing.
Right. So a year and 9 months, and then about 6 months, 6 to 8 months for USCIS to grant you the I-140 if you file in normal processing.
I-140 I would do as a premium processing case, most of it.
So given all that, like you said, 3 years, I think, is definitely three, I would say even four, in case you don't run into any of the hiccups along the way with companies and audits and things like that. Not to sound all doom and gloom here, but USCIS has made some updates to their policies, I guess, and things that I actually saw through your LinkedIn page. Thank you for making all of us aware. And if you're not following Manjunath, I think you guys should on LinkedIn. He posts a lot of data updates about USCIS. And a couple of things that you posted on LinkedIn spoke about the updates that they've made that caught my attention specifically was to allow H-1B workers to also be entrepreneurs. I want to talk about that and what are the provisions that are given for that. And secondly, also for to keep families together, they've made some changes to allow people who are tied to green card holders or citizens to keep them in the country a little bit longer. Can you talk a little bit about both of these?
Yeah, I mean, really, I would caution everybody. A lot of these are mere ideas and proposals, and a lot of it is not concrete yet. So I hesitate often to talk about things which are not really certain. But I, you know, if you see my LinkedIn, I'm a big proponent of a few things. One is, I'll get on my soapbox now. So you talked about how the H-1Bs, you know, nobody gets the green card within 6 years, right? After H-1.
Yeah.
So there was a time when you could get your green card in EB-2 in like 6 months, 7 months. When I got my green card a long time ago, I was able to navigate from labor certification to an approval of the green card, you know, in 7 months. Started in December of a certain year, and by June of the following year, I had my green card. That was EB-2 and that was India. And so then everything has gone, you know, has become a basket case. So I tell people that the framework we are operating now under is at least 35 years old. So I'm dating myself. So which means it doesn't work well for the current size of our economy. Back then, the economy was $4 trillion. And today, the economy is $27 trillion. So the number of visas you allocate is still the same. It's about 150,000 for employment-based. We heavily favor family immigration over employment-based immigration. And we are the largest economy in the world. And, you know, we need a heavy skilled workforce. So anytime I talk to lawmakers, I always tell people that you need to increase the employment-based numbers for everybody. And you need to remove the per country limits. So the backlogs get reduced for countries like India and China.
Right.
And then we also favor, like I said, family-sponsored immigration over employment-based immigration. This needs to really be changed, you know, flipped. And we need to favor employment-based immigration more than family immigration. So I think there's a lot of common sense reform which is required, both in terms of non-immigrant visas and also immigrant visas. Yeah. Non-immigrant visas, I always tell people, H-1Bs. For people who follow the H-1B, there used to be a time when under the Clinton administration, where they had increased the H-1B numbers in, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 32,500 visas every year. And then it had gone up to like 197,500 visas total from 65.
Wow.
So the point being, at that time, nobody would really use up all the numbers.
Okay.
So now, because the supply is so little, demand is so high, people misuse H-1Bs and the quota, you know, you have a quota and people can only file at a certain time of the year. So I'm a big proponent for removing quotas entirely. Let the market forces control how many number of H-1Bs they need. People will file throughout the year. You don't need to file on April 1 or April 1 through June 30th. It's just the, by not making any changes, we have created so many inefficiencies in our non-immigrant visas and also in immigrant visas. Those are some things I really wish somebody in Congress listens. And they're not easy. It's a tough sell anytime you say remove quotas or remove per country limits, increase employment-based immigrant visas. But they do intuitively understand. I've talked to lawmakers here our congressman from the District of Georgia. I talked to him. I spent almost an hour and a half having breakfast with him, and I explained to him. So when you explain the concepts and when you explain the problems, they see it, but things don't move beyond that. Those are my, you know, my, that's why I said I'll get on a soapbox. So I really hope that we see some changes, at least in the near future. But at the moment, I mean, you know, we just have to wait and see, you know, and some of the changes they're making to the H-1B program can also go in the reverse direction. Yeah. It can make it tough. So I'm not entirely certain how it's all going to play out.
Yeah. I agree. I tell people too, specifically when they say that I have time to get my visa stamp and things like that, I usually tell people, you have no idea when the next COVID is going to hit or what's going to happen. When you have a chance to go back and get your visa stamp, get it.
Get it done, yeah.
So that's the other topic I wanted to kind of address, right? A visa stamping. That's another kind of hassle, I would say, today for people who are kind of trying to travel internationally and things like that. You know, it's also become kind of a way of life to travel these days, to see the world, trying to get out there more. But another thing is, when you're working in the US and you are on an H-1 visa, you have to make sure that your visa is stamped so that you can get back in the country, you have a valid visa. So for a lot of this, especially with, actually, not just with India, for everybody who's out there, they have to go back to their home country, get their visa stamped, and then come back. One exciting program that I think was done earlier this year was to allow people to get their visa stamped within the US. I think there was a pilot program that took place. So I wanted to ask about updates on what came out of the pilot program, and is this going to be implemented so that people don't have to kind of, you know, plan the trip, go back. Appointments are, as usual, very hard to get for visa stamping. So I think having it in the US would improve, I mean, would give a lot of people a lot of peace of mind.
Yeah, that's a very important topic. And, you know, as you know, there used to be a stateside visa revalidation program prior to 9/11, before 2001.
Yeah.
Most of the people who are currently in the US on H-1B did not even know that such a program exists.
Yeah.
So then I made a LinkedIn post on this sometime back, maybe 3-4 years ago, telling people that, look, there used to be a program like this where you could send your passports and your 797 approval notice to St. Louis, Missouri, and you could get your visa revalidated, stamped in the US. And that post of mine got 1.4 million views, you know, whatever you call it on LinkedIn. So got a lot of response that showed like people did not know about this. And then we always talked with the State Department to say, to let them, encourage them to implement this program. And as you correctly said, they didn't come out with the pilot program this year. It was a very, very limited duration program. It was only open for a few weeks. Really, they have not released any data as to how it worked. And the idea was for them to try a pilot basis for only the H-1Bs and then expand it to H-4s and others. Nothing has happened. Nothing has come out of it. Keep following up with the State Department. I really hope they do it. And it's a win-win if they can do it, because they can charge a certain fee for it. And obviously, it becomes a revenue source for the State Department, right?
Yeah.
And then the other benefit for them would be, it'll ease up the burden on their consulates. And consulates coming out of COVID, they were really hit with like staffing issues. Consulates in India were only operating at like 20% staffing level coming out of COVID. So that was the main reason why the backlogs were so enormous at consulates in India getting appointments. It's eased up a bit, obviously, compared to immediately after the end of COVID, but still, you know, it's not easy. I mean, it takes time to get appointments. And if you go there and you get a 220, you're stuck for even longer. I think there's a lot of merit to the stateside visa revalidation program for them to extend it and, you know, make it charge, make it a source of revenue for the State Department, implement with your teams, talking about, you know, State Department expanding capability, and people will benefit, and State Department will also benefit. So we are following up on this, and we don't have any updates at this time. Really hope maybe by at least by next year they come up with something. Hopefully they have learned something from the pilot program and they're able to expand it. The main reason why it was taken out in 2001 in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 was security. Those were the concerns, and there are ways to address it.
That's very interesting, actually, that they actually had a program like this. I didn't know either until you just told me.
Yeah. So look at my LinkedIn post on that from a few years ago.
Yeah.
And enormously, I mean, people were unaware, and so many people liked it.
So I guess, you know, they did do a pilot program, and they are, I guess, looking at a few things. What other things are USCIS, that you are aware of, are USCIS planning to implement to help with immigration reform in general?
I really don't see anything on the horizon at the moment.
Okay.
The problem with our Congress is they want to tackle everything, at least on one side, and they talk about comprehensive immigration reform. Mm-hmm. And my thought on that is, why do you need comprehensive immigration reform? Separate them, handle them in pieces, you know, and focus on employment-based immigration separately, focus on border issues separately, focus on family immigration separately, focus on asylum and refugee issues separately. You don't need to put all the eggs in one basket and see if you can tackle all of it. And that's a recipe for not getting anything done. And last time we came close to getting a CIR, Comprehensive Immigration Reform, done was in, I think, 2006, you know, when George W. Bush was the president and he was supporting of it. Senate had passed the bill, and the Tea Party types in the Congress killed that bill, and it never went any. So since then, really nothing substantial, nothing concrete has happened. So I'm an employment-based immigration lawyer, so I advocate on behalf of those kinds of issues, or for those issues. And I really think for anything to get done, need to separate these issues out. And they're too complicated, and you cannot really combine one with the other. And that's the problem we see. There are certain forces within the stakeholders here who want to see everything combined. And I am for separating the pieces, and let's tackle one issue at a time. And the likelihood of getting anything done is higher if you do that. I hope something happens before I retire. I don't know. Very helpful.
But even then, I would say that your LinkedIn page, just in general, with all the information that you give out to folks, I think is very important. It talks about a lot of things. I suggest all of our viewers to give Manjunath a follow. There's a lot of information there, even if you're not aware of that. There's one more question that I want to ask, and you can choose not to answer this question. I guess, what are your thoughts on what would happen to immigration reform with the change in government coming up?
I'll answer it. Okay. Last 4 years, we have seen fairer adjudications, and the adjudications are not subjective, meaning there is some consistency, uniformity in adjudications. We do get RFEs and we respond to them, and we're able to get the cases approved. I cannot say the same thing about the prior administration before this. And the adjudication was so subjective, when you would file two cases and nearly identical, one would get approved, one would get denied. So global mobility decreased. You know, people stopped filing for all these visas companies because they were tired of like spending money and not getting the results they were hoping for. And people like us, lawyers, you know, relied on employment-based cases for our business. We saw a decline in revenues. You go back to other Trump administration, you'll see the same kind of change. I can assure your viewers of that. So people who can vote, they need to get engaged, and they need to elect the people, right? So. If anything, we'll go backwards for sure.
Yeah.
And it can hurt us all.
That's
and I've seen that.
Either. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So what I mean, what would you advise someone today who is on an H-1B visa? You already mentioned like that, you know, that they should start applying for their I-140 within the first 3 years. But also another thing that you raised at this moment is that companies actually have to spend money to get your I-140 to sponsor you for the employment-based green card, which is another big topic in today's economy, right? Companies are trying to cut corners wherever they can to save money with the inflation and everything that's going on. So this could be another place where they decide not to move forward for the first couple of years. So what is your advice to someone who's working, say, a tech company, and what should they do? How should they interact with their employer about wanting to file for the I-140 and getting their...
I would say talk to the HR at your company and make sure they support your green card process early on rather than later. And anytime I have a conversation with employers, I always tell them, if you don't file, somebody else. So the employee will take his H-1B and go to another company, and they will be happy to start the employment process for the employee. So your loss will be somebody else's gain. It's a good employee, good resource, and they're working on well for them. And I always tell people, and be consistent, and this is employers. You have a policy saying that you would like to try the employee for a length of time, that's okay. I mean, you know, if your wait time is 6 months, that's fine. But after 6 months, do support the employee with the green card process. Because the second thing I also tell employees is look at EB2 NIW. If you guys are working in critical areas, maybe that's a path to explore. You can self-petition, meaning you don't need an employer to sponsor that. So that way, you have an independent I-140, which you can use for H-1 extensions. And lastly, you know, start sooner rather than later. And if you're in a state, in a place where you feel like the employer is not going to support you, don't waste a lot of time, then, you know, you're all bets are off, right? So if you wait until the last minute. So you need to take some action within the first 3 years of your H-1B. So that would be my advice to foreign nationals who are in this boat, you know, trying to navigate through the green card process and also make sure they reach certain milestones that their H-1Bs can be extended.
All right. That's a great message to leave us with. Is there anything else that you want to tell our audience about anything that's going on with USCIS that they should be aware of? Or should we all just follow you on LinkedIn? You'll get the information anyway.
Follow me on LinkedIn because I genuinely try to post things which are of interest to people and, you know, comment on it. So people benefit, right? So it's all about knowledge sharing, information sharing, and we can assist any of your client, viewers in any way. In contact us, they can go to our website, lokrela.com, lokrela.com, and they can follow me on LinkedIn.
Yeah, nice.
And contact me. I'm happy to help always.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Manjula. I think this was also a very interesting session for me specifically as well. I learned quite a few new things. And I think selfishly, I put a lot of the questions that I had in my mind for this interview. But I hope it helps a lot of people. Thank you for joining us.
Well, you guys do a wonderful job, Nandini. It's a service to people. I'm glad to have helped you guys. And let me know how it goes.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll keep coming back to you with more immigration updates as we have more.
Absolutely. Take care and best wishes.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.